Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
All of this has a really chilling effect on journalists because this threatens our abilities to do our job, to hold powerful people accountable, because it's a way for authorities to look for confidential sources.
News organizations and press freedom groups are denouncing last week's police raid of a family-owned newspaper in Kansas, the Marion County Record. The paper's 98-year-old co-publisher died a day after officers also searched her home. The Kansas Bureau of Investigations probing the police raid will go to Kansas for the latest. Plus, Democratic lawmakers are renewing calls for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to resign after ProPublica published another bombshell investigation showing that a group of conservative billionaires have showered Thomas with 38 luxury vacations, 26 private jet flights, 12 VIP passes to sporting events, all worth millions. Then to Montana, where a judge has ruled in favor of a group of young people who sued the state in a landmark climate change case.
This ruling is just so important in Montana and for outside its borders. This is such a huge issue, and for the judge to say that Montana is significantly contributing to global climate change, it just kind of leaves me with this feeling that our actions do matter.
We'll speak with one of the youth plaintiffs and the head of our Children's Trust, which has been involved in a string of groundbreaking climate lawsuits. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hawaii officials have started identifying victims of the historic Maui wildfires as the death toll reached 106, with hundreds more missing, if not 1,000. Maui police named the first two victims as 74-year-old Robert Dyckman and 79-year-old Buddy Jontuck, a beloved musician who once played with bands including Santana. As many survivors express frustration with government relief efforts, communities have set up sites to distribute food, clothes, and other assistance to those in need. Meanwhile, Hawaiians are sounding the alarm over outsiders who almost immediately started preying on survivors to buy up land and property around the historic town of Lahaina, which was all but decimated in the fires.
Some of the things that's already been happening is realtors are calling families who lost everything, offering them to buy their property and their home for pennies on the dollar, just pennies on the dollar. So it's pretty offensive to us that people won't even give us the time to grieve properly. You know, people's mental health has been diminished in all of this. They've lost everything. People have lost family members. And for them to have that disrespect to come in and already try and buy things up is out of control. So some of the things that I've been doing is gathering all of our community leaders, getting as much resources as I possibly can at the same table so we can speak on how we can prevent these land grabs from happening.
President Biden said Tuesday he will travel to Hawaii as soon as he can, saying he didn't want to interfere with recovery efforts. Tuesday marked 2 years since the return of the Taliban to power in Afghanistan after a failed U.S. invasion and a two-decades-long occupation. Afghans face spiraling human rights and humanitarian crises made worse by the U.S. refusing to release billions of dollars in Afghan deposits in U.S. banks. And the Taliban's ban on women working in most sectors, preventing the UN and other international aid agencies from delivering services and operating in Afghanistan. Women and girls have largely been erased from public life. This is 24-year-old Hosna in Kabul.
I didn't think the Taliban would take over the country one day. And after they succeeded, their restrictions on women have increased day by day and caused us many problems. As far as I'm concerned, the victory day of the Taliban is the worst day for the people of Afghanistan.
A UN envoy has called on the International Criminal Court to prosecute Afghan officials for crimes against humanity over their treatment of women and girls. According to the UN, more than 1.6 million Afghans have fled the country in the past 2 years, with Pakistan receiving the highest number of refugees, around 600,000. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Afghans who are employed by American forces or contractors have been awaiting resettlement in the U.S. or for their visa applications to be processed. Many now say they're stuck in limbo. 18-year-old Marwa, whose father worked as a guard for an American NGO, lives with 11 other family members in a tiny rental near Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, as they await news of their U.S. visas and dwindling savings.
Here we only have one room with a kitchen. Our space is very tight. We cannot go back to Afghanistan. My father will be killed. We want to reach our destination as soon as possible to study there because everything is favorable there. We can neither study nor live here and in Afghanistan.
Meanwhile, the Committee to Protect Journalists called on the Taliban to end its persecution of journalists, lamenting, quote, Afghanistan's once vibrant free press is a ghost of its former self. In Burma, at least 32 people have been reported dead after a massive landslide Sunday at a jade mine in the town of Pakan. Several people are still missing while heavy rains have hampered rescue efforts. Burma produces between 70% to 90% of the world's jade. Climate and human rights groups have denounced the industry for its destructive impacts on the environment, corruption, and the deadly conditions faced by mine workers. Jade mining is estimated to produce billions of dollars in profits for Burma's military regime, with China being a major buyer. In 2020, more than 160 people died after torrential rains triggered landslides in another jade mine in the region. Pyongyang made its first public statements on Private Travis King, the U.S. soldier who crossed into North Korea on July 18th while on a guided tour of the demilitarized zone and has not been heard from since. North Korean state media reported Tuesday King, who is black, fled to the country in order to seek refuge from racism in the U.S. military. Travis King's family has told reporters he'd spoken about the racism he faced as a soldier and called the situation a big nightmare. King had spent 2 months in a South Korean jail on assault charges, was due to return to the U.S., where he faced disciplinary procedures. In Paraguay, Santiago Peña was inaugurated as the new president Tuesday. The former International Monetary Fund economist is a member of the conservative Colorado Party, which has been plagued by accusations of corruption during its 70-plus years in power, with its ruling streak broken only once between 2008 and 2013. Peña opposes abortion and same-sex marriage. In his inaugural speech, he reaffirmed his government's support for Taiwan.
Our relationship with the Republic of China, Taiwan, is an example of Paraguay's friendly spirit with nations towards whom we have great affection and with whom we feel not only allies, but also brothers. We will continue to negotiate with the world without compromising our sovereignty, territory, values, and culture.
Taiwan's Vice President William Lai attended the inauguration. In Louisiana, young people imprisoned at the state penitentiary known as Angola and legal groups are asking a federal judge to take emergency action and order the removal of children from the notorious prison. The ACLU and other rights groups say kids, the majority black boys, have been locked up for the past year in abusive conditions on Angola's former death row, an adult maximum security prison with a history of human rights violations. The ACLU says, quote, research shows youth in adult facilities are more likely to commit suicide, suffer from sexual assault, and experience exacerbated mental health challenges, unquote. Hearings in the case will continue through Friday. In Texas, a woman who helped cover up the 2020 murder of 20-year-old Fort Hood soldier Vanessa Guillen has been sentenced to 30 years in prison. Cecily Aguilar pleaded guilty to helping her boyfriend, soldier Aaron Robinson, dismember and dispose of Guillen's body. Aguilar was the only person charged in Guillen's murder. Robinson killed himself shortly after being questioned by police. Robinson was accused of bludgeoning Guillen to death in April 2020. She'd spoken out about being sexually harassed at the military base, which was renamed Fort Cavazos earlier this year. Guillen's murder brought global attention to the epidemic of sexual violence in the U.S. military and inspired some federal policy changes in the handling of sexual harassment and assault allegations in the military. Donald Trump said on social media he'll release a 100-page report Monday that would exonerate him, he says, after a Georgia grand jury indicted him and 18 co-conspirators for attempting to overturn Georgia's 2020 presidential election results. The Fulton County Sheriff's Office said Tuesday Trump and his 18 co-defendants are expected to surrender to police and will be booked at the Rice Street Jail. Trump was given a deadline of August 25th to turn himself in. The jail is open 24/7, the sheriff added in a statement. This all comes as the first Republican presidential primary debate will be held next Wednesday, August 23rd. One criterion to appear on the debate stage is a pledge to support whoever emerges as a Republican nominee. Those who otherwise qualify but have not signed the pledge are Donald Trump, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and former Vice President Mike Pence, though he said he will sign. If Trump is the front runner, they have to support him. In Illinois, a man has been sentenced to 10 years in prison for the arson of a Planned Parenthood in Peoria. Tyler Massengill admitted to using a homemade explosive to set the clinic on fire in January, just days after Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker signed into law sweeping protections for people from out of state seeking an abortion in Illinois. Massengill will also have to pay $1.45 million in restitution. The Planned Parenthood clinic plans to reopen in 2024. In education news, Arkansas officials told high schools not to offer advanced placement African American studies, warning students would not receive credit for taking the course. The Republican governor, the former Trump spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders, issued an executive order in January banning what she called indoctrination and critical race theory in schools. One school affected by the move is Little Rock Central High, where some 100 students were enrolled in the course this school year. Central High was home to the Little Rock Nine Black students who in 1957 tested the landmark Brown v. Board of Education ruling that ordered the desegregation of schools. On their first day, they were met with angry white mobs and National Guard members. President Eisenhower was forced to order federal troops to escort the students for the remainder of the year. In related news, many colleges in Florida say they're dropping their AP psychology course due to Florida law, which bans discussions on gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Earlier this month, Florida backtracked on a directive effectively banning AP psychology, but educators fear the repercussions of teaching the course since it would be all but impossible to do so without violating the anti-LGBTQIA so-called Don't Say Gay law. And in Oklahoma, the ACLU and other groups are suing to stop the state from funding the nation's first religious public charter school. The groups say the St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School will violate rules for publicly funded schools, including indoctrinating students in religious beliefs and, quote, discriminate in admissions, discipline, and employment based on religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, and other protected characteristics. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Kansas Bureau of Investigations has launched a probe into last week's police raid on the newsroom of a local newspaper and the home of its publisher and co-owner, Eric Meyer. Police seized computers, hard drives, servers, and phones. Eric Meyer lived with his 98-year-old mother, Joanne Meyer, who was co-publisher of the family-owned newspaper, the Marion County Record. One day after the police raid, Joanne Meyer died at her home. The paper blamed her death on the police raid, saying it had left her, quote, stressed beyond her limits. At the time of her death, Joanne Meyer was talking about the raid, saying, quote, where are all the good people to put a stop to this? She died mid-sentence as she expressed outrage over what happened. The raid reportedly stemmed from a dispute between the newspaper and a local restaurant owner who accused the Marion County Record of illegally obtaining information about a drunk driving incident of its owner. But it appears the newspaper had also been actively investigating Marion Police Chief Gideon Cody over sexual misconduct charges at a previous job in Kansas City. Details about that investigation were on a computer seized in the raid. During the raid, the police chief injured a reporter's finger while grabbing her cell phone out of her hand. Over 30 news organizations and press groups have published an open letter to Marion's police chief blasting the raid, writing, newsroom searches and seizures are among the most intrusive actions law enforcement can take with respect to the free press and the most potentially suppressive of free speech, unquote. On Tuesday, I spoke to Sherman Smith, editor-in-chief of the Kansas Reflector, a nonprofit news outlet. He describes speaking to Joanne Meyer on the phone as the police raid on her home was taking place.
The first call that I made Friday when I found out that this raid had occurred was to the home of the publisher and his 98-year-old mother. She answered the phone, actually, when I called, but she was very upset. There was a lot of noise around her. Police were rummaging through her house. She was having trouble hearing me, and so she told me she was going to have somebody standing near her and, you know, talk to me and let her know what I was trying to say. And then I heard a voice come on the line that says, I'm Sergeant so-and-so, and he had no interest in talking to me when he found out that I was a reporter.
And the next day, she passed?
Yeah, you know, the Marion County Record reported that she wasn't able to eat after the raid began Friday morning. She wasn't able to sleep that night. And early Saturday afternoon, in a conversation with her son, she apparently collapsed and died mid-sentence.
So, Sherman, if you can go back to the beginning and explain what exactly took place. You've got this paper dealing with two stories, and how did this raid happen?
Yeah, there's a lot of small-town drama to unpack here, so I'll try to keep it as simple as possible. There was an incident in town where Congressman Jake LaTourneur, Republican from Kansas, was holding a meet-and-greet at a small restaurant in town. I had invited the media, but when the publisher and a reporter showed up from the Marion County Record, the owner of the restaurant, Carrie Newell, asked police to throw them out because they weren't welcome. She was not a fan of the paper. They wrote about this, and I should say that the congressman appears to be a sort of innocent bystander in all of this. The staff was apologetic, came by and did a one-on-one interview with them later at their office. But as part of the coverage of being thrown out of this, somebody contacted the paper and said, you know, I have some information that might be of interest about Carrie Newell. And this confidential source provided information about her driver's license history, a 2008 conviction for drunken driving, which was of interest because she was applying for a liquor license. And there was a question about whether this should preclude her from getting a liquor license. The paper, reporter at the paper then typed Carrie Newell's date of birth and driver's license number into a state database to verify the information they were given, did verify the information, but ultimately decided this wasn't newsworthy, in part because they felt like they were being used as some sort of a pawn in divorce proceedings between Carrie and her husband. So they decided not to publish, but they did notify police that they had received this information. The police chief then notified Carrie Newell that they had this information. Carrie became upset. She made some allegations at a city council meeting last Monday that accused the reporters of some sort of illegal activity. That became the basis for an alleged crime here. The alleged crime is identity theft, that the reporter, by typing her information into the database, would have committed identity theft. I do want to say that all of the attorneys that I've talked to about this say that the reporter's actions do not come anywhere near being a crime.
Can I ask you, why did Eric Meyer, the head of the paper, why did he call the police to say he's not doing this story, but he had this information?
He told me that he was concerned the newspaper was being set up, and so he thought police should have that information. And that then became the basis for the search warrant that was executed against them on Friday, that's alleging a crime of identity theft and improper use of a computer.
And can you explain what happened to the reporter? The police chief himself ripped the phone out of her hand, injuring her finger?
That's right. That's what the publisher, Eric Meyer, told me. You know, they came in, they were taking computers and other documents. The search warrant allowed them to take utility bills, hard drives, the server that they had for even advertisements, legal notices, that sort of thing. And the police were taking phones away from the personal phones away from reporters in the newsroom. And the police chief ripped the phone out of reporter Deb Groover's hand and apparently injured her fingers in some way.
And can you explain the second story that the paper was investigating about the police chief himself, Sherman Smith?
When I talked to Eric on Friday, he told me that when the city had hired the police chief, the newspaper received a couple of emails from people who alleged some misconduct at his previous job. I believe he was a captain with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. But the publisher told me Friday that the individuals who emailed them were not willing to put their name to the information and could provide no evidence to support it. They asked the police chief about these allegations. So he was aware that they had received this information. But the publisher, when I talked to him Friday, said he didn't believe it was a credible story because there was no evidence to support these allegations. And so, it's hard to say. I know he subsequently has told others that he believes this was possibly a motivation for the raid. But I just want to emphasize there was a clear motivation specified in the search warrant for why they were raiding the newspaper office. It's not clear to me whether the emails they received about the police chief's past really had anything to do with the raid.
Sherman, what's known about the magistrate judge who signed the warrant?
Yeah, in Kansas, magistrates, they're really not any qualifications. They don't even have to be an attorney. In this case, Laura Villar is an attorney with an active license, a former county attorney in the county over. Was the magistrate judge. I talked to her assistant Friday and asked if there could be some explanation for why the judge would sign what appears to be an unlawful search and seizure warrant, but didn't get any response back. We're eagerly awaiting the release of the probable cause affidavit that would have supported the search warrant to try to understand, why any judge of any qualification or not would have signed off on this.
Can you talk about what this raid means for other newspapers, for other press outlets, for your own, for the Kansas Reflector? Talk about the significance of what took place.
The Kansas Press Association put out an email to members shortly after noon Central Time Friday that said, we have an active situation here. And in my newsroom, we dropped what we were doing and kind of leaped into action because it just felt like a brazen attack on journalism everywhere, on what we do. And it has a chilling effect because we depend on confidential sources to let us know what's going on and to give us information. And they have to know that we're not going to talk about them and we're not going to give their identity or disclose anything that would put them in jeopardy to anybody else. If the police in Marion County are allowed to get away with this, it becomes open season on journalists everywhere in Kansas, where law enforcement would just need to fabricate a reason for suspecting a reporter of possibly committing a crime as a justification for taking everything in the newsroom and looking for whatever stories we're working on and who our sources are. That would effectively prevent us from doing our job of holding powerful people accountable and telling the public things that powerful people don't want us to know.
Tell us the story of the Marion County Record, the story of the Myers, really, right down to Eric, who's the publisher now, who just lost his mother. Eric, who was a journalist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who was a professor of journalism at the University of Illinois. Go back to his father and mother.
This is a 150-year-old paper, and his father began working there in 1948, worked at the paper for 50 years. The family has owned the paper since 1998 when they bought it to block the sale to a corporation so that they could keep it as a family-owned, locally-owned newspaper. I think there are papers in Kansas and small towns where the economic reality has just decimated the ranks of reporters. And there are places where police could have raided and found, a single 20-something newsroom employee who was scared out of his mind and didn't know what was going on, and the owner would be a corporation 20 states away. Police picked the wrong newsroom in Kansas to raid because, as you say, this is a family-owned paper, a publisher who had 20 years of experience at a large newspaper, then 26 years of experience at a journalism program at the University of Illinois. is basically running the family paper as a retirement hobby now because it is such a passion to him, and has a sizable staff, a remarkably sizable staff for a town of just 2,000. And he is defiant, insisting they will put out a newspaper this week, and they are fighting back.
Has the Kansas Attorney General Kris Kobach weighed in?
He has not. We asked for comment on Friday. His spokeswoman seemed to be surprised that the situation was taking place, didn't seem to know that it had happened yet. I think the Attorney General's in a kind of untenable position for making a public statement because he is statutorily obligated to defend public agencies, including police departments, if there's legal action. So if the Marion County Police are sued, Kris Kobach and his office would be responsible for defending them in court. So it's difficult for him to say anything now, knowing that it would then be held against him potentially in court.
Sherman Smith, before we go, what has been the response in the town of the raid on their local newspaper? And is there any push for the police chief to resign or to be fired?
I think Kansans just don't like drama. And I think a lot of the people in town, the ones that I've heard from, are just upset that they've become this flashpoint for controversy in a major national and international story. I don't think they like the attention. They like having a quiet, sleepy town. And that's where they're at right now. I don't know that they've formed an opinion or if there's an idea of whether they support the chief or not, but I think they would prefer the story go away.
And the police chief himself, has he been speaking out?
He has posted on the department's Facebook page. He says he believes the justice system will be vindicated when all the facts come out. He and the Kansas Bureau of Investigation director, Tony Mativi, both of them have issued statements saying that the media is not above the law, which I just interpret as gaslighting because nobody has suggested that the media is above the law. The reporter and the newspaper have been forthcoming about their actions. The question here is whether police can act outside the law.
And the city council?
The city council's next meeting will be Monday afternoon, evening, and we should get some clarity then.
Could they decide whether he remains the police chief?
Well, they certainly have the power to hire and fire the police chief, but nobody has said anything yet to suggest that'll be on the agenda.
I understand visitation for Joan Meyer will be held on Friday. A funeral service and burial will be held on Saturday. I think it sounds like from the level of her stress as this was taking place, not only at the office, but at her home, that she saw this as the beginning of the demise of journalism. Is that fair to say, Sherman?
Well, I think we can say that it's a tragedy that somebody who had spent her whole life practically supporting news and intimately involved with the local newspaper and the owner of the paper spent the last 24 hours of her life having her home raided by police in a apparently illegal and certainly undemocratic attack on the free press. She wondered where the good people supposed to be at right now. You know, it's just a tragedy that that's how her life ended.
Sherman Smith, editor-in-chief of the Kansas Reflector, a nonprofit news outlet. He's been closely covering the police raid on the Marion County Record and the home of its owners. Coming up, Democratic lawmakers renewing calls for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to resign after ProPublica published yet another bombshell investigation. This one showing not just Harlan Crow, but a group of conservative billionaires have showered Thomas with millions of dollars worth of vacations and jet flights and passes to sporting events. Stay with us.
Buses, trains, and cars, how grand we are. Little by little, we meet in the middle. There's danger in the dark.
Be out in the cold. It'll be illegal.
Hey, you
Wait, take it away. It's gotta be night and day, just a matter of time.